From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
As the baby boom generation begins to reach retirement age, California's senior population will begin to see significant growth. By 2030, the over 65 population will grow by 4 million people, and it will become a more racially and ethnically diverse population, with many living alone. And that has significant implications for the types of senior support services that will be needed in the future. Recently, the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California issued a report, Planning for California's Growing Senior Population, that discussed those implications, including the need for more nursing care and assisted living facilities, as well as the need for more healthcare professionals, especially those who provide home and community-based services for seniors. We'll hear from one of the lead authors of the report, Laurel Beck, policy analyst with the Public Policy Institute of California. The Senior Boom, Preparing for the Baby Boom Aftershock.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, as well as support from Era Energy LLC, Bonner Family Foundation, Community Medical Centers, Harris Ranch Inn and Restaurant, Nossaman LLC, Sagasser Watkins and Whelan, and Valley Children's Hospital.
The Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California recently issued a report entitled Planning for California's Growing Senior Population. Our guest, Laurel Beck, is one of the authors of that report. Laurel is an expert in health policy and the policy challenges relating to aging populations, and just happens to be an alum of my alma mater, the University of Wisconsin. So welcome.
Thank you.
How much has California's senior population, how much is it going to grow in the next 10 or 15 years?
So our report is based on Department of Finance projections, and we show an increase of 87% by the year 2030. And we focus on that year because that's when the last segment of the baby boomers will reach retirement age. And to put that in perspective, in 2012, there were 4.6 million Californians that were over age 65. And by that number, it will be, or by that year, excuse me, it will be 8.6 million.
Yeah, it's 87%, or in other words, it almost doubles.
It almost doubles, yeah. 4 million more seniors.
Wow. All kinds of opportunities and situations to think about.
Mm-hmm.
So let's take a little closer look at the elderly and how the senior population is changing in California. How is it changing ethnically?
The change in the racial ethnic composition is going to be significant. The numbers of seniors in each racial ethnic group is going to grow, but some race ethnic groups are going to grow faster than others. In particular, we're going to see the fastest rates of growth among the Latino and the Asian Pacific Islander populations. So one example is that in 2012, an estimated 18% of seniors in California were Latino. And in 2030, that share is projected to grow up to 26%.
Now, quite a substantial increase. So what about males and females? They say that females live longer than males. Are we going to see a large female population?
Actually, we think that it's going to go in the other direction.
Really?
We're expecting to see a slight uptick in the number of males as a proportion of the population, and that's kind of because of some gains we've made in life expectancy on certain health conditions. There's a lot of reasons for it. But based on Department of Finance numbers, we think that the share of males in the population is going to go from about 44% in 2012 to about 45.5%. And that sounds small, but it's actually pretty significant in terms of in these kind of demographic projections.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising, actually. So let's talk about family structures. This idea of single and divorced versus married. Or on the other hand, having children versus not having children. How many California's seniors are going to change in that regard? How is it going to change?
It's going to change a lot, we think, actually. Based on survey data, we looked at previous trends. And when you think about it, in the 1970s and 1980s, we saw shifts away from sort of traditional mom, dad, and two kids family structure. People were less likely to get married starting around that time. They were less likely to have kids. And those people are now reaching senior age. So we're anticipating seeing seniors that are more likely to have never been married, they're more likely to be divorced, and they're more likely not to have children.
But if they're never been married, they could be with someone and just not married.
That's true, and that's absolutely true. That we could we may not be picking up on specifics, like if you're cohabiting versus being.
Happened a lot in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, absolutely. So we may be overstating that. But in terms of the number of people in surveys who report that they've never been married, there's going to be a pretty significant uptick. And we think that the number of people who have never had any children is actually going to go up significantly. So one statistic we cite in the paper is that in 2012, 12% of 75-year-old women had no children. And by 2030, we project that number is going to be 20%. So one in five women are going to not have children, which is a pretty significant part of the population.
That's a big jump. Mm-hmm. Again, almost another one of these doubling of the percentages. So the composition of this of seniors in California in 2030, very different than historically has been the case.
Absolutely. We think that along a number of dimensions, our report focuses on the demographics, but in a lot of ways, seniors in 2030, seniors looking forward, are going to look pretty different than they have in the past.
Now, I want to ask a little bit. I really wasn't addressed in your report, but it's still a very important issue, I think, though, for seniors, and that is fewer workers getting traditional pension plans, more and more getting this 401k option. And the problem is that even those that get the 401k option, a lot of times they don't really use it, and they're putting away too much too little money. What are your thoughts on the economic situation of California seniors going forward?
So I think one important point is that income and wealth are harder to predict than demographics. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that depends on how the overall economy does, how the housing market does, how financial markets do. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little less able to make kind of hard predictions about that. I do think that your point is absolutely taken. People with defined benefit pensions had more predictable income streams.
Which is the traditional pension.
Yes. Versus a shift to 401ks. And you do see lower take-up of 401ks than you saw of defined benefit type plans. So I think that there is reason to worry, there always has been, but maybe more going forward, that people are not saving enough, that they are not going to have enough resources to support them in the way that they are hoping to continue living as they age.
Okay, well, thank you for that description of the key demographic trends in California's emerging senior population. So what are the implications of those trends? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Our guest is Laurel Beck, a co-author of a PPIC report entitled Planning for California's Growing Senior Population. So you state in your report that California's senior population is going to grow substantially in the next 10 to 15 years. But what are the implications of that?
I think that the growing senior population has implications for a lot of policy areas. But basically, any policy that affects people is going to be affected by a growing senior population. In this particular report, we focus on what that growth means for the demand for support in daily activities and what the state will need to do to anticipate the need for facilities and health workers.
Yeah.
But it really, just think of a policy area and more seniors.
And you're thinking, I'm going to talk more about this later, but I'm sure in terms of living in place and all the health workers that are going to be required to make that happen, because as you get older, you're going to need some assistance, particularly if you're not married and or don't have children.
Absolutely.
So what about the ethnic makeup of California seniors? You said that was going to change rather dramatically.
Yes.
What are the implications of that?
We find that according to the data, people from different racial ethnic groups tend to demand different services. And that we want to be a little careful saying that because they may have differential access to services as
Could
well.
Could you give me an example of that?
Just, we may see that, for instance, African Americans use nursing homes at a higher rate than other subpopulations tend to, whereas Latinos tend to use nursing homes at a lower rate.
And any explanation as to why that is?
There's a lot of things that may be... there's a lot of different theories. One of them is that maybe African Americans, for whatever reason, have less access to home and community-based services. You can also, some people point to cultural differences, which is a
Latinos
very broad,
have extended families, perhaps.
Yes, and maybe more of a desire to try and remain in home as opposed to going into nursing homes. So it could be preferences among consumers. It could traditions among families. It could be information differences across urban versus rural communities, so that I think it's a pretty complicated issue, but we do see in the data different rates of staying at home versus using nursing homes across different racial and ethnic groups.
Yeah.
You also see different marital rates across racial and ethnic groups.
Sure. So. Well, let's talk about the male-female makeup of California seniors. I mean, you indicated in an earlier segment that actually the portion of seniors that are male is actually going to go up a little bit. Any implications of that?
I think that there may be some. I don't think it's going to be nearly as much of a driver of changes as we would think from the racial and ethnic differences. In our data, we do find that men are slightly more likely to require some assistance with daily activities than women are.
You're saying men are needy?
But I think compared to the racial ethnic trends, this is a relatively small small difference.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the consequences of this changing family structures. I think that's going to be probably a pretty big issue. As the senior population have different family structures than they have traditionally in the past, what are the implications?
I agree with you that this is a really big issue. As we age, we are more likely to need help with daily activities, and this can be health care, but it can also be personal care or errands, going to the store. It can be chores like cooking and cleaning. And we know that family members are major providers of those types of services.
Right.
So as we project that there are going to be more seniors that are unmarried or have never had children, then they're, one, less likely to have family to provide that type of support. But we also in our data find that for a lot of reasons, people who say I've never been married are also a little more likely to require some support. So we think this is a population that the state needs to be particularly sort of aware of and focusing on, because they're more likely to need external support and it's more likely that they're going to come in contact with state programs.
Yeah. What about the potentially worsening economic situation for California's growing senior population? We were talking earlier about the traditional pension plan that people could rely on. Those have gone the way of the dodo bird. I mean, very rare, except maybe in the public sector. Now more this 401k situation. What are the consequences?
The biggest consequence that we highlight in this particular report is that the role of state programs is going to become increasingly important. Disabled and low-income seniors will qualify for Medi-Cal and other programs like in-home supportive services. But we're going to see a lot more seniors, and if an increasing number of them are qualifying as low-income, then a lot more people will be qualifying for these programs. And this is part of the reason that we emphasize that policymakers need to be following trends now and paying attention now, even though the bulk of the growth in the over 65 population is yet to come, because the more we plan and understand, the more efficiently we can use our resources.
You almost see that tidal wave kind of coming toward us and all the implications of that. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much for talking about those implications of this growing senior population. Up next, what are the implications of the aging population on caring for mom and dad? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. California's growing senior population is going to be more ethnically and racially diverse than past generations and more likely to live alone. What kinds of support services are going to be needed? We're talking to Laurel Beck with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, who recently co-authored a report entitled Planning for California's Growing Senior Population. So the number of seniors facing difficulty caring for themselves, how much is that going to increase?
In our report, we look specifically at that question, and we project an 89% increase in the number of people who report needing some kind of support, and that's going up to just over a million people in the state.
And you think about that, 89%, our population isn't going to increase 89%
No.
In the next 15 years, yet this need is going to increase, so it's dramatically more than an increase in the population, so it puts it in context. What about estimating the number of people who are going to have difficulty caring for themselves? How did you come up with those estimates?
So what we did is we started, the Department of Finance puts together wonderful projections looking
at... And this
is
the State Department of Finance.
The California Department of Finance.
Okay.
And they put together wonderful projections on the age, racial, ethnic, and gender makeup of the population looking forward into the future. So we combine those populations with survey data, and we look at the effect of age and gender, but also your educational attainment, your marital status, whether or not you were born in the United States, and use those different factors to sort of predict the likelihood that you're going to require some care. Mm-hmm. So that 1 million people requiring care takes into account trends in racial, ethnic makeup of the population, and as well as the household composition of the population. So we try really hard to take into account how different the seniors are going to look in the future.
It's a guess, but it's an educated guess.
It's a very educated guess.
I don't want to say the guess, because I know you look at a lot of variables and you make sure it's statistically relevant and all that, but you're projecting.
Absolutely. There are things that could change things significantly.
Okay, so I'm assuming that many, if not most, seniors are going to have, even those having some difficulty living on their own, still want to stay in their homes. Is that true?
I think it is true. I think that the question is what home means. I think that a more consistent statement is people want to have as much autonomy as they can and as many choices as they can, conditional on their health needs. For as long as they can,
right.
Exactly. But I think that one thing you worry a lot about with the senior population is isolation, is getting removed from the community.
Right.
And a lot of people want to be engaged. They want to be either living with other seniors or living in a more, in an environment where they're within walking distance of libraries or stores or other parts of the community.
One of the things I find that's interesting when you talk to some seniors is sometimes, they understand that. And senior living is pretty independent. But you hear this a lot. Oh, I don't want to be around old people. But, you're older. And I think the mix, sometimes I think we kind of make the mistake of segregating old people, into just with other old people.
Mm-hmm.
And really, maybe a mix with younger and old would be maybe a more vibrant community for some of these folks.
Absolutely.
And the kind of services we're talking about here are going to be, if they're in home healthcare services, that's going to be required if they're living at home, correct?
I think when in this particular report, we look at a survey question that says, do you require some support with some activity of daily living, which is a pretty low bar, and we don't really get into more serious levels of needs. It's just sort of a yes or no. And so in that respect, that 1 million number is picking up a pretty broad range of needs. It can be people with very high-level health needs, and it can be people who need help with more basic things like personal care, bathing, and dressing.
Well, let's talk about that, because there is a range of needs and services that go to those needs. One is assisted living. What kind of services do assisted living places provide?
Assisted living, you can think of it broadly as sort of a stepping stone between totally independent living in your home and the high-level health supports provided in nursing home care. So most assisted living facilities provide help with things like preparing meals, housekeeping, managing your medications. It's a community where you just don't have to do all of the things that come with home ownership or independent living.
Meals are provided,
exactly.
That kind of thing.
But they don't provide, as a rule, the kind of really high-level health care, 24-hour service that most nursing homes provide. There are some facilities that kind of cater to that spectrum and that provide both assisted living and nursing homes, but in general, when you think of assisted living, it's sort of a middle ground.
Okay, so you've kind of answered the next question I was going to have, what do nursing homes do? So there's a difference between assisted living and nursing homes.
Absolutely.
But let's talk about the numbers for nursing homes, the end of the continuum in terms of they need a lot of assistance. Are those numbers going up, down? Staying the same, what?
So, in general, since the 1990s, we've actually seen a steady decline in the rate of people using nursing homes and the number of people in nursing homes. A decline.
Does that correspond with more people wanting to stay in a home?
It's people wanting to stay in home. It's the increasing availability of things like home health aids or people coming to help you with enabling you to stay in your home.
When you're talking like that, it makes me think of grocery stores that will bring now the groceries to your home.
Absolutely.
And that didn't exist 10, 15 years
Absolutely,
ago.
Exactly. And another thing is I think that the the medical community also appreciates that outcomes can be better at home, so that there's a little more collaboration between medical providers and patients in trying to make that a reality.
We've only got about 30 seconds left in the segment. I want to ask you about the costs of nursing care versus in-home or assisted living. What are the cost differences?
It ranges tremendously. It depends a lot on what your needs are, where you live, what type of, I'll emphasize again, what your needs are. Do you need health supports or basically personal care supports? We cite one statistic in the paper, which is based off of the AARP's website that estimates costs, and they have an estimate. If you live in LA County, that it would cost a little over $70,000 for a semi-private room in a nursing home, and more like $42,000 for a home health worker to come 40 hours a week. But there's a lot of ifs.
Right. But it's much less expensive to be in assisted living versus nursing.
Yes.
A nursing home.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's obviously a growing need for senior services. Up next, what should California policymakers be doing in anticipation of this senior boom? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Our guest is Laurel Beck with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California, who co-authored a report on California's growing senior population. So the question here is, what should the state government do in anticipation of this future wave of seniors? So should California policymakers anticipate a demand for increased spending on programs like Medi-Cal or in-home supportive services?
Absolutely. Most seniors have the majority of their health care provided through Medicare, the federal program, but low-income and disabled seniors qualify for Medi-Cal, which both provides health services and pays for nursing home care and has other programs associated with it, like in-home supportive services, IHSS, which pays for people to bring support workers into their home to provide with personal care. They don't provide health services, but they do help people stay in their home.
And sometimes those could be family members.
Yes.
As well. And there's also discussion, a little bit off the track here, there's been a discussion in the legislature about whether those in-home supportive services employees should be allowed to unionize. And so that becomes a whole other issue, because chances are if they unionize, they're going to have better pay and benefits. That will lead to a cost somewhere that someone's going to have to pay. So there's a lot of things going on here that have policy implications. You know, you state in your report that it's helpful to think of two broad categories, where seniors live and what type of workers they're going to need for help. So let's start with where seniors live. You anticipate that most seniors are going to prefer to remain in their homes. We've talked about that. So how or who should pay for those services? If they want to stay in their home, they need in-home supportive services, who's going to pay for that?
For the most part, people are going to be responsible for paying for them on their own. If you aren't low income and don't qualify for Medi-Cal or some other government programs, this is something that you need to anticipate in case anything happens and you require some support. For people who do have low enough income to qualify for Medi-Cal, they can qualify for IHSS, and there are some other programs which will allow the state to subsidize bringing workers into your home. But I think another thing to keep in mind is that the vast majority of these services are provided in an unpaid way by family members. It's children supporting their parents and spouses supporting each other. It's a really big burden on family members of people who require some support. And so it's not a direct financial issue, but is more about time and resources.
Right, yeah. The caregiver is also a person that's in the equation. I think people, when they're doing their financial budgets for retirement, they need to probably be thinking about, they may need some support as they get older, and maybe not thinking about that. So what about assisted living? Who pays for that?
For the most part, that's another thing where people are on their own. There are some very limited cases where where Medi-Cal will cover assisted living. There's a program called the Assisted Living Waiver, which subsidizes assisted living care for a pretty specific subset of Medi-Cal beneficiaries in a certain subset of counties.
But I think it's like 15 counties, like I read in your report, a very small group.
Very small group. And so for the most part, Medi-Cal will cover you if you need nursing home care, if your needs are intense enough that you require that level of assistance. But for assisted living, it's
and just to put it in context, and if I'm wrong, I'm sure someone will correct me, but I think it's 58 counties in California, yeah. So 15 out of 58 counties, a small subgroup. What about nursing home care? Who pays for that?
It depends a little on what your needs are. If you need long-term nursing home care sort of indefinitely, and you're low income and you meet a number of other financial requirements, then Medi-Cal will cover it. If you're in a nursing home to recover from a medical event or a surgery, then Medicare will usually cover that if you are a Medicare beneficiary.
So Medi-Cal is a big player in the nursing home situation.
Yes.
Can you briefly describe how Medi-Cal is funded? And also, when you talk about Medi-Cal, a lot of times you hear people talk about managed care. Can you kind of talk about those two issues for a moment?
So first, Medi-Cal is funded jointly between the federal government and the state government. In California, as a rule, it's a 50-50 split on Medi-Cal expenses between the state and the feds. Managed care is an effort that's going on across a lot of states, including California, to try and make care for people who have intense health needs more efficient, to coordinate across different providers. If it's different, if it's your nursing home director, your in-home workers, your doctors,
what they do, I think, in Medicare, if I understand you, correct me if I'm wrong, is with managed care, what they do is they say, you know, pay this amount per month and we'll take care of all the services, as opposed to a fee for service.
Yes.
Plus we're going to pay for each one. So the assumption is in the former, in under managed care, that the company, who's ever providing it, has an incentive to keep you healthy so they don't have to provide the care. And so it's more preventative as opposed to, you know, after the fact with, you know, fee for service.
Yes. And
I hope I made that clear.
I mean, it's a complicated thing. It's also to help reduce duplication of services across different providers and to make sure that everybody involved in a certain patient's health is on the same page about what they're receiving, what they need, and trying to save money in doing it.
Let me ask you this. Workforce development. I mean, obviously, you talk about healthcare workers. That's going to be, the demand's going to be changing, who we need there, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. So when we talk about an increasing number of seniors and an increasing number of people needing support, that's the demand for services. So we're going to need a commensurate increase in the supply of services as well. We're going to need people with pretty specific skill sets. A lot of them are going to be allied health workers who are, when you think of health workers, you think of doctors and nurses.
But that's not what you're talking about here.
Here we're talking about home health workers, nursing aides, medical assistants, people who can be trained at a community college.
Right.
And so it's going to be important that the state think about the capacity of community colleges to train them.
Well, I want to thank Laurel Beck with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute for joining us. If you want to keep up with state and local politics, you can follow the Maddie Institute on Facebook, Twitter, or log on to our website at maddieinstitute.org. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
From News Talk 580-1059 KMJ, this is the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
Emergency room visits are often thought of as a healthcare system's true safety net, since no one can be turned away. What impact has the historic expansion of Medi-Cal coverage under the Affordable Care Act had on emergency room visits? We'll ask Sharon McConville, a health policy expert with the Public Policy Institute of California.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. BNSF Railway, moving our economy for 160 years. BNSF, the engine that connects us. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Emergency room visits are bad news for the patient and the healthcare provider. What's happening to ER visits is the focus of our program today. With the expansion of the Affordable Care Act, have they gone up or down? Our guest is Shannon McConville, who's a senior research associate with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California and co-authored a report looking at those very issues. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk about the role of ERs. Has the law made any, some kind of requirements when it comes to people who show up at the ER?
It does. So, and that's actually a federal law that was passed in the 80s. It's EMTALA is what it's commonly referred to, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. But essentially what it means is that if people present at the emergency room and they need to be seen, screened, stabilized, and provided with any necessary medical care that they need, regardless of whether they have health insurance coverage or whether they're able to pay for it. And while there may be some, you know, there have been discussions about what exactly, you know, necessary medical care might mean, it really is one of these foundational components of our healthcare system and access to care.
What was the ACA supposed to do when it came to ERU?
You know, the ACA didn't explicitly try to address the emergency room, but I think the goal is that if people have health coverage, then they have other sources or other places to access care that they need. And so that in turn, you know, should impact affordable care use, hopefully reducing it, although, you know, that may take some time. And, you know, we're still relatively early on in the ACA implementation.
Yeah, and people's thought was, okay, if we have insurance, people are going to go to their primary physician, not use the ER. ERs are expensive to use anyway.
Right.
They're probably going to drive down healthcare costs. It's probably the assumptions, and we're going to see if any of those assumptions are correct.
Right.
Let me ask you this. So when you look at ER visits, what do you find? Who uses the ER?
Well, I mean, everybody uses the emergency room, right, when they need medical things. But not surprisingly, probably really young children and seniors have the highest rates of ER use, you know, when we control for their size of the population. Among the non-elderly adults, so adults over under 65, women from age 18 to 34 are the highest users.
Childbearing
age, and about one in seven visits for that group of women, 18 to 34, is related to pregnancy-related concerns. So that is likely one of the reasons.
That's not surprising.
Right,
I mean, I would
exactly.
think for that population. You'd also would frankly expect it of older population too, probably going to use.
Of course,
the ER.
And even young children, right? I mean, the first year of life is you know, it's a fragile time for parents and children.
On either end
and
of the life continuum. I mean,
that's right.
Know, with my elderly mother, I mean, they were getting pulled, you know, like a lot of parents, they end up going to the ER for lots of high blood pressure or whatever. Let me ask you this. You hear a lot about these things called frequent flyers, those people who frequently use the ER. Do they account for a disproportionate share of ER visits, and what strategies have been used to kind of reduce their use?
Yeah, they do, actually. And so, you know, when we think about anyone who visits the ER at least once in the year, ED patients, right, about 65% of anyone who uses the ER only goes once in the year. Then you have this other group on the other end of the spectrum. So among patients who use the ER 10 or more times in the year, it's only about 1% of all the people that go there.
So not too many do that.
Not too many do that, but they account for about 12% of all ER visits. And so when you think about, you know, 65% only make one, then you have this, you know, only make, or sorry, 65% of the population make 35% of the visits. Then you have the 35% that make 65% of the visits. So it does drive at least some of the use that
You know,
we
I noticed
see.
Something you said there, you let slip out. You said something called ED as opposed to ER. We, you know, we talked about this off camera. Can you explain? I mean, I use ER visits during this our conversation because people, I think, understand emergency room. But
that's right.
In your report, it says ED. Why?
The emergency, I think emergency room is our common term, but the, you know, the role of emergency rooms has really evolved over the last 50 years. And now they are these relatively large departments. You have medical physicians trained explicitly in emergency medicine. And so they're really taking on a bigger role within the healthcare system. And that's really grown from the time when, oh, you have this, you know, relatively small space staffed by maybe one or two physicians that are there overnight to really be this comprehensive, you know, piece of the delivery system.
Yeah, that's why you use the term emergency departments as opposed to ER. But we're going to use ER.
Okay.
So let me ask you this. So looking specifically at ER visits in California, have they gone up or down over time, and how do we compare to other states?
Right. In California, they have been in kind of slowly trending up. We have data from state discharge records from starting in 2005, and so we looked at that period, 2005 through 2016. And yes, we've seen an increase Actually, it's grown from about, total visits have grown from about 10 million to more than 14.5 million in 2016.
So even my math, I can figure that out. It's about 40%.
That's about 40%. When we adjust for population, it's still sizable. It's still about a 30% growth in ED over that entire time period. In general, California has lower ED use than the nation. I'm not sure explicitly compared to other states, but generally we are a bit lower on ER use.
Okay, so how much, what's accounting for the increase in ER use? I mean, are these visits outpatient visits? Are they avoidable?
Yeah, so most of them, so we categorize things as either outpatient ED visits, which means that the emergency room visit didn't require the patient to be admitted to the hospital, say, overnight. They were discharged the same day they received the care. So those are outpatient visits. And yeah, the bulk of the increase has really been on this outpatient visit. Visits that resulted in an admission over the time period only grew by about 7%.
Okay, well, up next, we're going to talk about whether insurance coverage matters when deciding to go to the ER. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Shanna McConville with the PPIC about ER use, emergency room use. Let's take a closer look at the relationship between health insurance and emergency room visits. You indicate that there are well-documented differences in ER use depending on insurance coverage. What are they?
That's right. So those that have public insurance coverage, so that would be Medicaid in California, that's Medi-Cal, or Medicare, which is the coverage for seniors, people over 65, they have the highest rates across all the coverage groups. The lowest rates are for the privately insured, and the uninsured kind of fall somewhere in between.
Okay. So is the difference just comes down to cost?
It's not just cost, although cost is related. So, you know, amongst the uninsured, we may think that they use a lot because they don't have access to other sources. And while, you know, they do use more than the privately insured, typically when you're uninsured, you still face a bill. So that probably, you know, reduces ER use among the uninsured in some cases.
In your report, you had something about copays, and you think, oh, if someone has to pay some money toward an ER visit, it'll kind of stop them from using it.
That's right. And I mean, that's how private insurance kind of tries to curb our use of emergency rooms. So I know for my private plan, I think my ER copay is $200, which does make me think about, should I go or should I try and get an appointment the next day?
Right.
You know, as opposed to Medicaid or Medi-Cal, there typically people don't have any share of cost when they, and that's part of, you know, the law. And so that could contribute. There's other evidence, though, that other things are contributing to, say, high use amongst the Medicaid population, lack of transportation, the inability to get an urgent appointment. So while I may be able to call my doctor and say, hey, I really need to be seen today, there's some evidence that that's harder for those that are covered by Medicaid.
Well, because the payment reimbursement rates are lower, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So who's showing up, you know, to the ER? Has that mix changed as a result of the passage of the ACA?
We didn't see too much of a change, I would say, in terms of, you know, patient characteristics, say race, ethnicity, or gender. What we did see was the coverage source, which is not surprising at all. So right before the ACA in California, about 30% of ER visits were made by uninsured residents, and that share went down to about 12% in the post period, and basically the increase was Medicaid. Medicaid was around a quarter, 25% of ED visits in the period prior, and now it's up to almost 50%.
Yeah, because a lot more people are now covered by that. A huge part of the California population.
Yep.
By the way, a lot of these outpatient or inpatient?
A lot, So when I talk about, actually, that's a good point. The coverage that I just mentioned is only for outpatient visits, and it's only amongst adults, actually, which were really that are non-elderly adults, that population 19 to 64, which really were the target group for the Affordable Care
Act. And to be clear, see, I had to look at this. Inpatient are those where hospital admits, I would assume.
That's correct.
And outpatients, you walk in, take care of it, and you go home.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay, so that's the difference between inpatient and outpatient.
Yes.
Okay, there's something in your report called presumptive eligibility. What does that mean, and how does it impact ER use?
And so that is a feature of Medicaid and so Medi-Cal in California. What that means is that Medicaid will cover you even if you are not enrolled at the time you receive care. And so the reason that it's there is really to help reimburse the providers, the safety net hospitals, the places it goes. So for example, if someone who's uninsured goes into the emergency room, needs treatment, the hospital can screen them for being eligible for Medicaid, and the Medicaid program will pay or will cover that visit, even though they weren't enrolled. And that's very different from, say, private coverage. If you don't have coverage and something happens to you, it's not as if you can go get coverage then, because that's how insurance doesn't work that way.
That was kind of the issue behind kind of the ACA, and that there were a lot of, you know, these charity cases, frankly.
Right?
They'd walk
Absolutely.
Into the ER. They got to be treated. Law requires it. And who's going to pay? The hospital's going to pay. I mean, ultimately, the consumer pays. because someone has to pay that cost. And with the ACA, what you have now is a program now that with through Medicaid that the government pays for it. And hopefully, if they're getting care, that they're not using the ER as much maybe as they would in the past. Let me ask you this. If the ACA went away, what would you expect in terms of ER visits?
That's a very interesting question, and I don't know. I think it's hard to know. Okay. You know, I would guess that if we didn't see other changes in, say, our healthcare delivery system or how we think about the role of the emergency room, I would guess that they would kind of continue to go up as we've seen them do, you know, in the years well before the ACA was even passed.
No, okay. Well, up next, we're going to talk about the ACA and the fact that it's ahead on ER visits. It's made it less necessary on the one hand and also less expensive on the other. Is that good or bad? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Shannon McConville, a senior research associate with the Nonpartisan Public Policy Institute of California about ER use in the age of the Affordable Care Act. It would seem that if you have increased health insurance coverage, like the expansion brought about by the ACA, that will result in a decrease in ER visits because people aren't waiting until the last minute and they have an emergency and run to the emergency room for a medical condition. They're being proactive instead of reactive. So, for example, taking blood pressure medication or watching your cholesterol is better than having a heart attack, which is much more obviously more expensive, bad all the way around. You would think that's the case. Is that the case?
Well, I think it's a hard question to answer. On the one hand, yes, insurance coverage should give you access to, especially since so many of us are covered by managed care, but you have a primary care provider who's trying to help you manage, you know, your health and your conditions, and so you do want to be proactive. On the other hand, as you mentioned, the costs change maybe how you behave. I'd also mention that for folks who say we're uninsured for a very long time, it may take a little while to understand how you use coverage, how you use outpatient resources in order to manage certain things, how you become more, say, proactive in your health, and that might take some time. And so while our study looked a few years after the Affordable Care Act, it may be that it might take more time in order to see some of those decreases that we hope for in, by expanding coverage.
Have we looked at other states? I assume you've looked at other states. For example, Oregon or Massachusetts. Let's talk about that for a second.
Yep.
Oregon has taken a look at this. What do they find in Oregon?
Oregon actually found an increase in emergency room visits as a result of a Medicaid expansion. And the unique thing about Oregon was this predates the Affordable Care Act. Okay. And what they did was, as a state, they decided to expand just their Medicaid program, their state Medicaid program. And they did it in a way that they kind of created a lottery, which for people who do research was a really big opportunity. And they were able to kind of randomize things. And so, all of these, most of the studies that we do in this space, we're not able to randomly assign people. You're going to be insured, you're not going to be insured, right? In Oregon, they actually, because they only had a certain number of available slots, they created a lottery. Then they tracked people who both got that, who applied to get that coverage, but also that group of people who applied, so also needed it, but didn't. And so when they did that, they actually found an increase in emergency rooms. And they found that actually emergency rooms seem to act more as a complement for, say, physician visits and things, rather than a substitute, which is what the decrease would make.
So Massachusetts, though, they didn't find the same thing, did they?
Massachusetts didn't, although, and this is something our study is largely, looks a lot like the study that was in Massachusetts. They found a substantial decrease.
So we're going in different directions.
We are, and actually, there's evidence kind of across the board, and it's mixed, I would say. And so I think some of that has to do with, there are these different factors involved, but you have very, say, different populations. You have different access to what the provider networks look like outside of the hospitals in these different areas. And I can't not help think that does impact what we find.
Okay, what about nationwide studies? Anything conclusive nationwide?
So there's been a few studies nationwide that have kind of exploited the Affordable Care Act and the fact that some states chose not to expand their Medicaid program. And so that's a really common kind of research designed to help us understand what's going on. One of those studies did find a slight increase in emergency department visits. Another study that looked at a subset of states saw a decline for certain groups.
Here we go again.
And so I think that's why we wanted to do this in California, to see
variables.
Exactly, and to see what we could find.
What does all this suggest then for California? In particular, these studies, what do they suggest? What should we be doing?
Well, you know, California, I mean, we always comment when we think about California in the context of, say, other states or the nation, we're so large, we're so diverse, right. You know, when we compare. And we do really have several different healthcare markets. You know, the Bay Area health care market is very different from Los Angeles or the Southern Cal to the Central Valley, and there are
even within the Central Valley,
right.
There's a difference between, you know, Northern Valley, Southern Valley, and the central part of it.
Of course, and so, you know, I think what it tells us is that things may be different here, and they may even be different across the state. I'd also say that in California, our Medicaid expansion, the expansion of Medi-Cal, really drove a lot of our coverage gains that we saw, and so to the extent that that's slightly different, I mean, that's true across most of the states that expanded Medicaid. But ours was very large, and so I think that's,
you know,
that's
there was a
the
term
things.
You used in your report, which I thought was a great word, and that was the word disentangle, because there really are so many variables that are impacting this. It's hard to kind of, it's like a Christmas tree light, trying to figure out, okay, how does this actually work?
Right. I mean, and even in the studies that try and say, you know, that we, I mean, there's evidence and we try and get at it, but like, what role does health insurance play on how you access healthcare? Because there are so many things that go into whether you're insured and, you know, under what coverage. And so it really is hard to kind of understand how different people's behaviors and selecting into certain places impacts their care in a way that we can try to be causal about this causes this. And healthcare is, and coverage is one of those
things. And longitudinally, over time, people, as they get used to it, their actions may change.
That's right. And I mean, and that's really the hope, honestly, that coverage does provide you with better access. You can learn how the healthcare system should work. You can create relationships with primary care providers and then use it better and manage your health.
Yet another variable. Okay.
Well, it's true. There's lots of things.
Yeah. Well, up next, we're going to have a further discussion about how the ACA has impacted ER use. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Helper with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Shannon McConville of the PPIC about the impact of the Affordable Care Act generally and ER visits in particular in California. Let me ask you this. Uninsured rates in California prior to the Affordable Care Act, I assume there was wide variability between inland California and coastal California. Big differences?
That's right. You know, statewide prior to the ACA, about 18 to 20% of Californians were uninsured. In some places in, say, Southern California, Los Angeles, the Central Valley, that was more in the 25% range, so nearly a quarter of residents. And we've seen them drop precipitously. So statewide, our uninsured rate is down to, I think, 7 or 8%.
Wow.
So it's a
10
percentage point drop, which translates into more than 3 million people who used to, you know, be uninsured and are no longer uninsured. And that's true across. And so, and the places, the areas of the state that had the highest uninsured rates, they've seen larger declines.
Right, right.
So they're getting down lower, too.
Is there a correlation between how many undocumented people you have and uninsured rates?
Well, I think there is a correlation in the post-ACA period. So the Affordable Care Act largely excluded undocumented immigrants from the coverage expansions.
Which, by the way, people need to understand that undocumented are not covered.
They're not. They were not covered. They were not covered by the ACA. And so there are some estimates that suggest of the, you know, they're about just under, based on most recent things, 3 million Californians that still remain uninsured. And it's likely that more than half of those are undocumented because they don't have access to some of these expanded coverage options.
So what did your statewide analysis find? Did ACA the ACA passage of the ACA reduce ER use?
We did, actually. So in our analyses where we looked at all 58 counties, we found that yes, emergency room use declined. Declined post-ACA. And the way we did that was we looked at counties that had those really high uninsured rates in the pre-period, and we compared their trends with those of really low uninsured counties. So in some ways, like Los Angeles, Fresno had high uninsured rates, certain counties in the Bay Area much lower pre-ACA uninsured rates. And so when we look at the trends, we assumed that they would stay parallel if not for this policy change. And so then we kind of used that difference. And what we found was that among, again, we were focusing on adults under 65 because they were the main group. Mm-hmm. And we found that outpatient visits among non-elderly adults declined in the post-ACA period, not by much, by I think about 10%, and that the declines were really focused on the group of more middle-aged adults, say age 35 to 54.
So that was where you saw the biggest decline in ER use?
That's right.
So that was, and these are what, Hispanic males, non-Hispanic white males?
Actually, so we looked at it both by gender and age and race. Mm-hmm. We saw declines for males and females in that age group. We didn't see many significant differences across the racial ethnic group. So we didn't do men, like Hispanic men or Latino men. We did men of certain ages, and then we did the entire group of non-elderly adults by race.
I think I read in your report that men and women kind of use the ER differently, don't they? I mean, men typically, I think, a little bit more inpatient. In other words, they don't go until they really, really need to go.
Yeah, we broke down kind of what outpatient, what diagnoses were common amongst men and women,
right,
in the thing. And yes, we saw more men. Men were more likely to be admitted. They had more injury-related visits. So some things that maybe you aren't maybe that surprising, but yeah, there are some slightly different patterns. And again, for women, pregnancy, you know, at least for these non-elderly adults, do kind of drive at least some of their usage.
Which is kind of interesting. I mean, I'm just asking the questions. I don't know, would something like Planned Parenthood be taking care of the outpatient stuff if not for ER?
You know, you hope that Planned Parenthood can be one of the places that people access. But, you know, OBGYNs and prenatal
right.
care is part of, you know, is coverage, right? Exactly. And it's covered for everyone. And so you'd hope that there's, but, you know, when you're pregnant, there are a lot of concerns and things happen in the middle of the night. And the ER is where you go in the middle of the night.
Right, right. That's true. So what are your conclusions after looking at all of this? What are some of your basic conclusions?
You know, I mean, I guess I think that it's promising that we didn't see, you know, I think going into this study, it wasn't clear what we might expect given the mixed evidence. And so I think it was reassuring in some ways that we didn't see big increases in ER use. Because I think if you look at the trends and, you know, you might think, wow, this is really burdening, or, you know, this expansion in coverage, particularly Medi-Cal coverage, is really impacting, you know, ERs
right.
that are these community things that we all want to be available to us. And we didn't find evidence of that. And I think that that's promising. I think, you know, but it is still concerning, or we need to think about how emergency rooms fit into our healthcare system.
But one of the things I think that I took away from reading your report was it would have been worse without the ACA.
Right. That is what we find. You know, in our full 58 county analysis, that's what we find. The rates would have been higher, particularly in these high uninsured counties. Right. Their trends would have continued going up, and they flattened a bit because of the ACA.
So some
that's
of the
our
things,
conclusion.
Some of the assumptions that were initially thought about with the ACA. Kind of true a little bit.
Well,
a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I would just reiterate too, we're a few years out from the coverage expansions,
yeah.
And so I think as, you know, as long as things continue maybe the way they are, you know, as the more years that we go,
yeah,
we'll learn more.
We'll have to learn more. Well, thank you very much, Sarah McConville from the PPIC, for joining us. This is Mark Kepler for the Maddie Institute. Thank you for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed in the Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed in the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.